Good morning. Today is Friday, April the 23rd. Joining us this morning is meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service Office, Woodley Island Marina, Troy Nicolini.
Good morning.
Glad to be here. Oh, that was about as deadpan as anybody could get.
I was pondering how much you seem to really like my title.
No, I figure I get it right one time.
No, you got it right, but okay.
You know, this one you should be able to nail, considering your maritime hobbies.
All right.
You ready? Why is a ship's speed expressed in knots?
Oh, I know that. Would you like me to tell you?
Yeah, you knock it out of the park.
I will knock. So they used to measure the speed. They had this long rope, and they tied a board to it, and they tied knots incrementally across the rope, and they'd throw the board over the side of the ship as it was traveling. And there'd be one guy with one of those old sand hourglasses, right? And he would tip it over, and they would pay the line out, and one guy would be counting how many knots went over the rail of the boat while the hourglass ticked away for a minute, I believe. And then they would count the number of knots, and that's the speed of the ship.
Yeah, mine's got a whole bunch of numbers on it. You want the numbers?
Oh, yeah.
You're a numbers guy?
Yeah. I do know that a nautical mile is 1 minute at the equator. It actually has a physical meaning. One of the few measurements we use, it has a physical meaning.
Okay. Well, I think you got it right. You're tired, I'm tired. One knot means that 1 nautical mile per hour. 1 nautical mile is approximately 6,076 feet. The equivalent of 1/60th of a degree at the equator.
Or a minute.
There's your equator. Yep.
Yeah.
The simple calculation will show that if you're traveling at 1 nautical mile an hour, you're traveling 47.25 feet every 28 seconds. And if you're traveling at 47.25 feet every 28 seconds, you're traveling at 1 nautical mile per hour. Sailors of old used this relationship to measure a ship's speed. Each ship carried a light rope called a log line with a wood float. Okay. So you're scoring points left and right, yes. And a weight attached to one end with the knots tied every 47.25 feet. To measure the ship's speed, the end of the line with the float would be placed in the water. As the ship moved forward, the line would be pulled off the reel at a certain speed. If one knot was being pulled off every 28 seconds, the ship was traveling 1 nautical mile per hour, or 1 knot. If 6 knots were pulled off every 28 seconds, the speed was then 6 nautical miles per hour, or 6 knots.
Wow, there you go.
And so on and so on.
And it's actually reported as knots. I mean, it's nautical miles per hour, but so we actually say the wind is blowing 20 knots. Yeah.
Yeah, which is interesting because how do you,
Right, that doesn't have dimensions.
The connection between the boat and the wind is a little tough.
But it's used in aviation to measure wind speed. So when we report out to pilots wind speed, it's in knots. And then it's used in the marine environment, nautical miles per hour, for both wind speed and ship speed.
So when you're talking to the airplane or the airport folks, updrafts and things like that, do you guys measure those also, or is that something that's specific to the airport?
So we provide these things called TAFs, or Terminal Aviation Forecast. Yeah, pretty simple. And the pilot, so everything's in there, and what they're looking for is, convection that would lead to unstable air, and they're looking for visibility, wind speed, and any kind of weather phenomenon, and temperatures. So, and that goes out of our office for all the airports in this region.
So it does come out of here, not the airport specifically.
Yeah, we actually have a contract with FAA to provide aviation forecasts for all the nation's airports, big and small.
So how do you deal with the microclimates some of these have? Neyland certainly is far different than Ronerville.
And I should clarify, the bigger airports like Arcata, for example.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. A big and small meant like San Francisco, which is big.
Gotcha.
Arcata, which is small.
I see. Yeah. So more of the commercial flights rather than the private?
Correct. Although, interestingly, our forecasts in aviation right now are just worded forecasts for the airports. Everything else we do, you may have noticed, if you go on a computer and look for weather information, it's gridded. Like it's 2.5 kilometer grids of information. So you could find a place in Neyland, zero down that dot, and get what our forecast thinks the temperature will be. And so we're actually going that same direction for aviation at some point. That's been what we've been talking about, so that we would cover smaller airports like Neyland Airport.
So can the airplane guys then get that information in the sky, or they have to talk to whoever they're talking to on their communication devices to find out.
Yeah, they can pull up the TAF on a smartphone or something pretty easily, even in a small plane. Yeah, everybody has a smartphone.
Hasn't anything changed around here in the last 25 years?
Yeah.
I would suspect a lot of that is just the computer modeling, and you guys make sure that the computer program is working.
The human computer relationship is evolving in weather forecasting, like, and everything else, you know. So yeah, the computers are doing more and more of the heavy lifting for us, especially farther out in time. The value the humans bring is in the near term, and so for aviation forecasting, for example, you know, 6 hours, the humans can beat the computers significantly. There's a lot of experience and judgment that goes into, especially aviation forecasting around here. It's very challenging. Whether the stratus moves onshore or off, the models cannot pick that up. So,
oh really? So yeah. Something that's really easily visible isn't necessarily recognized by the models.
The satellite can pick it up now, right? But as far as predicting into the future what it's going to do, it's very challenging for the computer models and for the people, by the way. But the human experience and judgment brings a lot to that. But 6 days out, trying to figure out what the rain's going to be, the computers generally can beat the humans every time. Because the computers can do something humans can't do, which is let go of their bias. The models we use now will actually run lots of different models and then blend them together. And they basically say, you know, that's probably the best guess. It's almost like if you had a room of 50 people and you asked them to come up with an answer to what not is, and you average that answer, you'd probably get something pretty reasonable.
So it's almost like doing trending or historical knowledge rather than projection and out into the future.
Yeah, you might say that, yeah. Yeah.
So you look backwards to go forwards.
Yeah.
We've heard that about government.
Oh, yeah.
That was so easy to set the hook and just reel you in.
Well, that's actually the field. The farther out you go, that's the field of climatology versus meteorology, and then what's happened in the past really drives what you think is going to happen in the future. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would think that the whole projecting out is subject to all kinds of variables.
Yes. And at some point, you just can't track all the variables.
Yeah.
So you don't try. You give up.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, no, that's when you use statistical methods. You just, you know.
Yeah, okay, 5 years from now on July 4th.
Yeah, what you would do is you go back July 4th for the past 50 years. What did it look like? Right. That's probably what that July 4th is going
to
look like.
Odds are, ding.
Exactly.
Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. Troy, considering some of the different challenges that are out there, we hear about developments and things like this and housing. You know, Rex was on a couple of days ago talking about housing, and Tom Manson was on yesterday talking about bridges and things of that nature. How involved do you get at the Weather Service, or do various jurisdictions come and talk to you about rainfall predictions and things of that nature that they're using the human element rather than just what you have posted on the website?
That's a great question. Yeah. So, you know, we're the National Weather Service, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, right? So another agency in NOAA is the National Ocean Service, and they do the tides. And so there's no National Ocean Service office up here, but we're NOAA, so folks come to our door asking about tides a lot, especially I guess they used to more so. And rainfall and also design events. Sometimes folks want to know, like, what's the worst rain that we might anticipate so they can design for something. And so there's lots of different ways to slice weather phenomenon, rain, ocean tides, sea level rise, all those phenomenon, tsunami hazard. And so you know, our main goal is protection of life and property. But there's a regulatory side of the world that, you know, we sort of stay out of by design, because we want to make sure that we're an independent source of information, not someone that an agency that people, you know, end up angry at because we took a stance on a regulatory issue. For example, you know, where should you build houses relative to
interpreting.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, we just provide the data and folks use it to make lots of decisions and make their own inferences. But yeah, we stay out of the sort of discussion about you know, those hot topics.
But you are in the discussion providing information.
We provide the information, yeah. Yeah. So for example, NOAA does a lot of projections for sea level rise nationwide, and then agencies decide how to use that data. And you know, like the California Coastal Commission, for example, when NOAA provides a spectrum of possible sea level rise scenarios based on, you know, carbon emissions and things that we might or might not do as a society, the Coastal Commission picks which of those projections kind of resonates with their level of cautiousness about the future, for example. And so everyone picks their own. You know, someone who's more risk tolerant might decide to pick the middle of the road or even a lower estimate of sea level rise, for example. So
has anybody talked about global cooling? I know that was the big deal, what, 25 years ago, right?
I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, oh my, you know, here comes another ice age, and we had all the movies to support that. And now we've got it going the other way.
Yeah. No, I think the data, oh boy, we're going to go to climate change, aren't we? I think the data.
Not too far out.
Okay,
but
yeah.
It's interesting how it has changed so, you know, 180 degrees.
Well, you know, I read this report by the Pentagon of all agencies. Shoot, it's been 15 years ago, and I think that might shed light on why there's confusion. Any kind of change in the climate, you know, whether it's human induced or otherwise, can cause ripple effects. And I remember back then the Pentagon evaluated the potential of the shutting down of the warm water currents in the Atlantic, and what that would do in the near term would you know, water moves around the ocean that really affects climate. For example, we get a current here on the north coast of California that's coming from the north.
Yeah, the Alaska current.
Yeah. And so when the ocean air mass moves over that chilly, cold water and then comes on land, well, presto, you get our climate, which is relatively cool.
Right.
In the Atlantic, on the east coast of the U.S., the movement of the water is from the south to north, bringing warm water to the north, and then travels across and keeps Europe warm. So if that thing shut down because of climate change or whatever might shut it down, then you would actually get certain parts of the world getting a lot colder. So that, you know, that might be explain why some of the interpretation earlier was that it was a...
Well, and there are historical records going both ways.
I mean, right.
Growing grapes in Greenland.
Yeah.
And, you know,
well, we had an ice,
some of the years where there was ice and snow through London for the entire 12 months.
Yeah, and the Great Lakes, of course, were caused by glacial scour. So,
yeah.
So a lot of the lakes in that region. Yeah, so...
It just is interesting how some of this stuff. Now, could something like a significant plate shift in the tectonics, could that be enough to trigger change?
If Lori was here, my good friend Lori Dingler, she'd be saying weather and tectonics do not connect. There's no such thing as good earthquake weather.
No, not earthquake weather.
Yeah,
but of a shift to cause. I can remember one of the few classes I remember when I was at Humboldt. Dick Stepp was teaching, and we had this little, you know, modeling for fluid. You know, it could either be air, it could be water,
right.
but currents. And you put a little, you know, put a pencil in, and all of a sudden you see all of the ripples and the changes until it normalizes with that change.
Right.
At that point, it was talking about, like, filling in so that there would be a peninsula where there wasn't one. Okay, there are impacts, and you just got to, you know, look at it and realize that there will be changes. So something like an earthquake or that could cause a shift.
Yeah,
if it's more than a couple inches,
right.
I would suspect that some of these currents could then be altered.
Yeah. Oh, right. I see what you're saying, like the ocean currents, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, interesting. I ponder those questions sometimes myself, just because one of my areas of study when I was an engineering student was sediment transport, which is like the quintessential case of you perturb something and then those effects ripple down, you know. And when I first moved up here, Mad River had blown through straight to the ocean and then started to migrate its mouth back to the north. And so, you know, always intrigued by it, like what caused it to blow through the berm back then 20 years ago and now to build its mouth to the north, to the north, to the north, to the north, you know.
Or when it used to dump directly into the bay.
Right.
Oh,
which may or may not have happened, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, depends on who you talk to and what. Yeah,
I can provide my theory as to why it didn't.
Good. We'll talk about that when we come back. It's 8:30.
Hey, community. Times are rough right now. Retail shops may be closing, but the bulk flower market is still open and moving fast. We here at Bayer can help turn your flower harvest into cash today. Call Bayer Extraction House at 707-693-2222. That's 707-693-2222. Don't miss out. It is time to sell. Bayer Extraction House, your flower selling powerhouse.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Troy Nicolini from the National Weather Service. See, I'm just kind of condensing you down. Then it'll be, it's just Troy. Talk shop presented by CDH Painting, Redeck, Humboldt Termite Pest Control, Murphy's Markets, Baywood Golf and Country Club, Humboldt Bay Bistro, and Randall Sand and Gravel. Troy, looking at some of the historical stuff, you made comment before the break that maybe the Mad River dumped into the bay? In the north end, up the slough, and maybe it didn't.
I'm of the opinion that it would never have done that for any sustained period of time, and here's why. If you stand...
Meaning more than a flood.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, right, exactly. May have breached through and flooded to the bay for a while. But I've noticed all the rivers on this region, their mouths tend to migrate to the north until they hit a barrier. Or they go as far as they can until they just can't sustain that mouth, and then they break back through the ocean straight away. And I think the reason is... if you stood on the bluff looking down at the Mad River during the wintertime, we have a lot of south wind in the wintertime, right? So the south wind sets up a northbound current in the ocean. So as the river comes out in the winter, when it has most of the flow and most of its power...
It's chewing on the north bank.
It's being shoved to the north and chewing on the north bay. So I think they always migrate north. Now, like the Mad will turn right and go way up before it turns into the ocean. At some point, the ocean just gets fed up and says, I'm not going that far to go to the ocean, and it breaches... and starts a process over of migrating, so it blows through to the south and then it migrates to the north until it hits a barrier or it can't sustain its mouth. Klamath does that, the eel does that, their mouths move around, but they tend to move in that pattern, I've noticed. So that would suggest that the Mad River would really have a hard time deciding to turn and go into the bay for any period of time. It just doesn't seem like it's a natural...
Unless there was something else.
Some barrier there, right,
And but, you said it's not the earthquake.
Well, no, actually, that it could have been plate movement that could have,
That big one that they keep talking about, or that well, there's did the happen big,
there's
historically?
There's the big one, and then there's little ones mixed in. There's other
faults. There are some pretty good periods of time when there was a shift of
And now I'm getting in an area that I don't know enough about to speak intelligently, but there is a possibility that there was some land movement that would have redirected the river. That happens a lot.
But then again, it starts getting chewed away.
It starts chewing away, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, if it had flowed into the bay, the sediment load on a river like that, it would have filled the bay, and the bay would be a meadow at this point.
That's right. That's the one thing that I was thinking about, and I don't know how the Mad compares to the eel, but I think everybody's pretty familiar how much comes through the eel.
The eel, I believe, has the second highest sediment load per volume in the world.
Yeah, right behind the Amazon.
Well, we must have talked about that before. I don't know if you told me or I told you.
Yeah.
It's a great piece of trivia right there.
Yeah, we just need a couple of floods to blow it out, huh? Get back to the channels back. Some of those different types of challenges that are in there, there's this thing that's called a microclimate. Okay, you guys deal with it on a regular basis those little grids.
We have one in Fairhaven.
That's what I was going to ask. How many are there?
It's astounding. Nobody believes me because we're right on the coast, and they assume it must be the foggiest place in the Humboldt Bay region. But Fairhaven, I swear... Overall, now we don't have an observation site right in the town of Fairhaven, so we can't.
You can't find anybody in Fairhaven.
God, if I just knew someone there that could.
That's a pretty weak argument, but we'll go with it.
But I finally had one of the meteorologists in our office lived out there for a couple of years, and he backed me up because he would drive to Eureka to go to the office, and then he'd go other places. But I've noticed there's days when Fairhaven is sunny, and if you look in every direction, you'll see overcast and gray, and there's just this little plob. of sunshine on top of Fairhaven. It's very
Maybe
odd.
That's where the name came from.
Well, when you read that book of the history of Fairhaven, people back then thought it had a very bright future. And, you know, they were sort of wrong in some ways, in that it, from a standpoint of a community, it's had some rough patches, you know, from a residential standpoint. I mean, the pulp mills were great for the economy for the region, but they definitely were not good for that little teeny town that was just downwind of the stacks.
Right, yeah.
But, you know, the pulp mills are gone, and they've been replaced with amazing prospects for, you know, economic development that won't have emissions like that. So the town is has a bright future and a microclimate that is to die for, because it really can be nice in Fairhaven. They're sometimes really hard to explain, microclimates. My theory about Fairhaven, if you look at a map, it's the widest part of the peninsula, but it's actually very flat, meaning that the air mass that comes in off the coast is warmed up and therefore evaporates out the moisture that would cause, you know, stratus and overcast. So it warms it up. But there's nothing to lift the air mass. And when you lift air masses, typically that actually causes them to cool again. And that's what gives you
clouds.
Where
you get to,
yeah. So I think it's because this is my operating hypothesis. It's just because the peninsula is so wide and flat right there at Fairhaven. And Fairhaven's on the back side of the peninsula. So it has a mile of warm, sandy dunes to dry out the air before it hits Fairhaven. That's my theory. But they're often really hard to explain, microclimates, you know.
Well, I mean, there are certain things that you can look at, like the freshwater valley.
Right.
Okay, it always has the fog strip, you know, first one, because it's venting and going inland, or venting coming out. You know, that kind of stuff is pretty basic for a lot of us that really don't know too much.
Yeah, and the maritime air mass reaches that its finger into that creek valley or river valley. Same thing with the eel.
Right.
Yeah. You'll see it on its satellite sometimes. It's big, long finger of stress. It makes it all the way up, you know, to...
about Scotia.
That's Scotia. Beyond Scotia, yeah. I mean,
come around the corner and there it is. Yeah, yeah. You know you're coming home.
Now, another one that's interesting, so that's the River Valley microclimate. I described the Fairhaven one. It may or may not be valid. Then there's the Banana Belt. And you guys used to spend quite a bit of time up in Brookings, I believe, or maybe you still
right.
do.
Right, yeah. And the venting coming out of the Chetco, out of the Willamette. Valley.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean on the coast, like you'll get a section of sunshine in the southern Oregon
right.
coast. And, you know, and that I think is because of the Great Cape to the north of it. Like we have a Great Cape just south of us.
Yeah, Blanco sticks out pretty
Blanco
far.
Blanco sticks out and sort of protects the Banana yeah. Belt. And our Cape sort of keeps the Mendocino Coast sometimes a little warmer than our coast. So we're north of the Great Cape here in the Humboldt Bay region, and it just tends in the summertime to kind of almost scoop up the marine air mass and just kind of... You know,
lock it in. We see the same thing with the Klamath, though. Also, you know, you go through Klamath, and
it's often yeah.
It's you hit temperature there.
Yep.
I mean,
yeah.
It's really impressive once you're there. But
yeah.
I guess maybe the mad just is so long that you don't get that concentration of the heat coming out of the out
well,
of the valley.
Well, the mad doesn't have the Cape effects either. There's nothing. The mad's just on a big open section of
it's
coast.
Just,
so it's
yeah.
the weather. At the mouth of Matt is more being just driven by that maritime air mass coming in.
Well, as the eel is, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission wants you to know that local economic development agencies, business resource organizations, financial institutions, and jurisdictions are working together to provide resources for the COVID-19 pandemic. For more information, go to northcoastsbdc.org or call the OES Business Hotline at 268-2527. 268-2527.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:48. We're back talking shop this morning with Troy Nicolini. Troy, what is out there that's got your attention for the next little bit? Is it funding? Is it new pieces of gear, new computer programs?
Well,
what are you looking at?
Well, funny you should ask. I was eligible to retire last Tuesday, so.
Yeah, well, that one's not going to happen.
No, I'm just kidding. I mean, I am eligible, but I'm not ready to quit for sure. So, you know, we have fire weather season coming up. We're in a drought. Conditions are really dry.
Are we in a drought?
Yeah,
there must be a technical definition, but
well,
are we
yeah,
there?
And actually, interestingly, there's multiple definitions, but I would say, let me just say, without using that hot word, that conditions are dry, fuels are going to be dry.
We're going to have another year this year like last year?
Possibly, yeah. Certainly
okay.
to the south of us and possibly, you know, right on the coast, we're pretty somewhat, you know, immune from wildfire issues. somewhat. I don't want to jinx us.
But you're not going to see. You're not seeing that there's going to be a late spring rain series.
No, we're not seeing that. But we did have rain last pretty well. You know, it was a slow start to the season. We had some catch up rain, which is always nice. But we're going to end up dry for sure. And so that's probably what's on our radar screen now. And not just for this region, but sort of, you know, nationwide. Because some of our staff get deployed to fires all over the country.
They'll pick you out and shoot you somewhere?
We have a specially trained guy. It's called an incident meteorologist. And he basically, on a moment's notice, can hop on a plane and go to a fire somewhere.
Now that you got direct to Denver and Phoenix.
Yeah.
No excuses.
Yeah. No, exactly. So we're sort of monitoring the fire season, what it's shaping up to look like throughout the entire region.
In the past, we've heard El Nino, La Nina, Super Taco. Is there any of those that are out there now, or is this just kind of, yeah?
Just to sort of set the tone for that conversation about La Nina versus El Nino, we are at a very odd latitude right here. We're at the inflection point. So La Nina and El Nino have really solid implications for what the weather is going to look like in San Diego and in Seattle. Less so for us.
We're kind of in the neutral.
It really is weird, yeah. I mean, our biggest floods ever were in La Nina years. So 55 and 64 were in La Nina years. So there's something to suggest, some data to suggest that if it's a really profoundly strong La Nina, that we're a little more prone to get major flooding. But otherwise, the data is all over the place. We get flooding during El Ninos. We get flooding during La Ninas.
So it's just more of a West Coast.
Well, it's for us.
Where you hear about it, it's not necessarily our area.
Exactly. And actually, it's pretty clear for San Diego. And so for El Nino, San Diego is going to be wetter pretty solidly. And for La Nina, Seattle's going to be wetter pretty solidly. And then we're right in the middle, and so it can go either way, basically.
We're just kind of, we're here.
Yeah. Which is tough, because that's one of those climate things that we use to try and anticipate our seasonal conditions.
So there's influences, but we just don't take the brunt.
We don't take the brunt, yeah. Yeah. I wish there was a great analogy. I just can't think of one right now.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah. We can go to our baking, right? You got your two, with your handheld mixer, you've got your two blades going.
There you go.
We're
in between the two, the beaters, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're the solid in the cookie dough, baby.
We don't know if we're going to go this way or we're going to go that way.
Yeah.
That was a perfect analogy. I love food analogies, too.
Yeah. As long as we don't get sucked down, huh?
Yeah.
Bring out the spatula and we're in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, boy. You excited about the fiber optic line coming in? Is that going to help you guys out?
Yeah. It's interesting. We went to voice over IP phones, right? Internet-based phones a while ago, and I found myself thinking, like, boy, now everything's dependent on one wire coming in the building. You know? It's like one thing that can fail and take you down is unsettling. So, yeah, I think any redundancy in communications is really good for us. Our office to the north in Medford, it has some terrible comms failures from, you know, guys with backhoes. Oops. And now their office is shut down. We back them up. I don't know if you know, but we can back up one of our offices with just a few clicks of a mouse. And it's as if we're the Medford Weather Office doing all their work for them. And we bring in extra staff and they take a break.
So they come out to the coast and enjoy the nice weather.
But all it takes is one guy with the backhoe to take out, take out an office.
Amazing stuff. Hey, thanks for coming by. Nice to see you
again.
Thank
you. Nice to see
you. And I guess we'll hear you on Monday?
Yep.
All right. We'll look forward to it. See everybody then.